Well, good morning again. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you and to introduce our next speaker. U.S. Senator Mike Lee opens his online bio with the following sentence. Mike acquired his love for the Constitution early on while discussing everything from the Due Process Clause to the Second Amendment around the dinner table. Now, for those of you who were here last year for the Senator's remarks, I admit that I did open my introduction with this same quotation. But I'm not repeating it out of laziness. Rather, I mean to point out that Senator Lee's love for the Constitution, forged over meals with his distinguished father, former Solicitor General Rex Lee, has most definitely spilled into the well of the Senate, to the delight of some, and regrettably sometimes to the frustration and impatience of others. Senator Lee has been tireless in evaluating the business of the Congress with the Constitution as his compass. And like a good public servant who takes his oath of office seriously, he calls them as he sees them. Sometimes that squares well with the agenda of his Republican colleagues. Sometimes it doesn't. But in all cases, the senator approaches his job as the Founding Fathers envisioned, that the legislative branch, when acting within its sphere of authority, has the right and indeed a moral duty to ascertain the meaning of the Constitution and to live by its terms. For members of the Federalist Society, this may not seem to be of much magnitude. These are basic concepts of constitutional governance, after all. But for those who have been observers of the business of legislating in Washington, it will be obvious that Senator Mike Lee's operational principles are truly radical, and if they catch on amongst his colleagues, perhaps even game-changing. Senator Lee, it's been a privilege for us at the Federalist Society to know you and to consider you a good friend, indeed a part of the family, going all the way back to when you were president of the BYU law school chapter. So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in giving Senator Lee a most hearty and grateful welcome.
Thank you very much. I never get that kind of welcome on Capitol Hill. It's a wonderful thing to get it down here. I first spoke to this group a year ago, shortly after I was elected to the U.S. Senate. I've now had a year's experience, almost a year after being sworn into the Senate, to build upon some of the ideas that had helped get me elected. They've taught me a lot that I didn't know about the law, about the Constitution, and about something I knew relatively little about when I got elected, which is politics. I've analyzed this word as much as I can, and as a textualist originalist, I've found it necessary to break the word down into its Greek roots. It consists of poly, which means many, and tix, which are blood-sucking parasites. We learn much from the Greeks, don't we? During a recent Judiciary Committee hearing, we were privileged to have Justice Scalia, who, by the way, wasn't he fantastic last night? Justice Scalia was our special guest, and we had a hearing that was themed on the role of the judiciary under the U.S. Constitution. This was a rare opportunity for us to ask any question about just about anything we wanted, and I was going to make sure that we didn't let it go to waste. I loved his opening remarks at that hearing. He began by explaining that his love of the Constitution was properly rooted in much more than the Bill of Rights. As he explained, any tin-horned dictator can have a Bill of Rights. A Bill of Rights is something that's just written on paper. Whether or not that Bill of Rights is actually followed and those rights really mean anything depends on something else, depends on something that can't be provided, at least not exclusively within a Bill of Rights. As he explained, this is best exemplified in the Bill of Rights found in the Constitution of the former Soviet Union, which he described as a scintillating document, one with a profound respect for all these human rights, including the freedom of religion, the freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. And as he pointed out, the Soviet Constitution even went so far as to provide with particularity that anyone in government who retaliated against someone for speaking out against some government action would promptly be tried and imprisoned for doing precisely that. But as he explained, these provisions quickly became dead-letter law. They became completely useless. And in fact, the Soviet Union, surprising as this may sound, is not exactly known for its human rights record. This, as Justice Scalia explained, had to do with one simple fact. There was nothing in the Soviet Constitution that prevented the consolidation of power in the hands of the few. It's this consolidation of power in the hands of the few, or even in one government, as he explained, that is the true source of our constitutional protections, the true bulwark against tyranny. And it's that we should be more focused on in the Constitution. It's that for which we should be most grateful. It's that for which those who represent us, those who fight to defend us, stand so nobly. I should point out, since it's Veterans Day, how grateful I am for the men and women who have defended America throughout her history, and I'm very grateful to them on this Veterans Day. So the Constitution, as he explained, is something that is best understood and best praised for the fact that it goes out of its way to prevent the consolidation of power in the hands of the few or even in the hands of one government. And so we depend at the end of the day on those who hold office, whether in the executive branch, the legislative branch, or in the judicial branch, to remain faithful to their oath to the Constitution, to remain faithful to those principles, those rules that prevent members of any branch or the federal government as a whole from exercising power that does not properly belong there. Here's what he explained there. He said that the Supreme Court gives deference, this is a direct quote, quote, gives deference to legislation on the assumption that the members of the Senate and of the House have tried to be faithful to their oath. And if indeed they are not even looking at or thinking about the constitutionality of it, that presumption should not exist. Pretty startling words. Pretty startling words, in fact, given that over the last year I've seen that it frequently goes unasked whether any act of Congress that's under consideration is within our constitutionally enumerated limited powers. We need to ask ourselves this question all the time. Should we have this presumption? And to what extent should that presumption be honored? I want to get into the psychology that goes behind that in just a minute. But before I do, I need to explain why it is that our founding fathers felt that this was so important and why it is that this represented such a departure from what would have been understood as the default assumption about a legislative body at the time of the founding. The great William Blackstone, who was, by the time of the American Revolution, recognized widely and among the masses as as perhaps the single greatest authority on the laws of England, including the laws that were recognized in the American colonies. Judge Blackstone explained that the laws of Parliament were extensive. They were so extensive, in fact, that one could fairly say that if Parliament could envision a particular power, and if Parliament could see to it that that power were exercised, it could do it. There really was nothing off the table. Here's how he put it. He said that the English powers of Parliament were, quote-unquote, absolute and without control. Parliament, Blackstone went on to explain, had, quote, sovereign and uncontrollable authority in making, confirming, enlarging, restraining, abrogating, repealing, reviving, and expounding of laws, this being the place where that absolute despotic power, which must in all governments reside somewhere, is entrusted by the constitution of these kingdoms. It can change and create afresh even the constitution of the kingdom and of parliaments themselves. It can, in short, do everything that is not naturally impossible. I didn't realize that so many of my colleagues were reading Blackstone. His description is so appropriate of Congress as it operates today that it's frightening. And it ought to be frightening, because this was not an accident that in the Constitution we don't find anything like that. It's not an accident that in the Constitution the founders started with the proposition that we are going to give just a few powers to this national government, because national governments, as they observed, have a tendency to abuse power. They have a tendency to become tyrants, and we have to prevent that. And so they listed these powers as being few and enumerated, or as Madison described them in Federalist 45, few and defined, as compared to the powers of the states, which he explained were numerous and indefinite. Today, I fear we have flipped that understanding on its head. And we've done so as we have steadily, over the course of the last seven decades, abandoned the previously deeply rooted concept of coordinate branch construction. On a textualist, originalist basis, those who served in all three branches of government previously saw this as a very important thing, that each person who takes an oath to the Constitution has a duty to enforce its limits, has a duty to stand up for it, has a duty to recognize when it's gone too far, regardless of how profound or how necessary the particular policy under consideration might be in their estimation. Woodrow Wilson is far from my favorite president. In fact, he may have been the first of the four horsemen of the apocalypse insofar as federalism is concerned. Woodrow Wilson nonetheless recognized what would happen if we started to allow the barriers, the walls around Congress's authority to erode. He explained that this would cause some problems. He noted that the Constitution grants Congress the power to regulate between the states, to regulate the commerce between the states, and yet in that time, he said, attempts made during every session of Congress to carry the implications of that power beyond the utmost boundaries of reasonable and honest inference would cause problems. And he said that this ultimately would demonstrate, quote, that the only limits likely to be observed by politicians are those set by the good sense and conservative temper of the country. This explains what I tried to explain in a book that I wrote that came out earlier this summer called The Freedom Agenda, wherein I explained that members of Congress like to please. And because they like to please, they like to give. They like to have things named after them. They want to give money to good causes. And it's especially fun to give money when it's not yours in really big sums. And then they praise you when you spend. They praise you when you exercise power that benefits someone, and it always does. And really, the only limit becomes your own imagination. Unless, of course, you're tethered to some oath, unless you feel some almost religious conviction to the oath that you took not to exert that power, not to exercise it beyond what the text will bear. Wilson went on to explain as follows, quote, if the power to regulate commerce between the states can be stretched to include the regulation of labor in mills and in factories, it can be made to embrace every particular of the industrial organization and action of the country. The only limitations Congress would observe, should the Supreme Court assent to such obviously absurd extravagancies of interpretation, would be the limitations of opinion and of circumstance, close quote. I didn't know Woodrow Wilson was a member of the Federalist Society. And yet this is what we find today. This is almost exactly where we find ourselves today. Let's compare Woodrow Wilson's statement to a conclusion reached just recently by our own D.C. Circuit. Interpreting the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and in an effort to ascertain whether or not Obamacare could be sustained as a valid exercise of Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce under Wickard v. Filburn and its progeny, here's what the D.C. Circuit concluded. That in light of Wickard v. Filburn and its progeny, the D.C. Circuit explained Congress can regulate even instances of purely local conduct that were never intended for or entered into an interstate market, close quote. Thus, quote, the right to be free from federal regulation is not absolute and yields to the imperative that Congress be free to forge national solutions to national problems, no matter how local or seemingly passive their individual origins, close quote. Now, I don't agree that it is the inexorable command of Wickard v. Filburn that we have to give Congress, we have to assume that Congress has the power to tell Americans where to go to the doctor and how to pay for it, or that they have to buy health insurance, not just any health insurance, but that kind of health insurance, that specific brand or variety that Congress in its infinite wisdom deems necessary for every single American to buy under penalty of federal law. I refuse to concede that Congress's power goes that far, even under the blunt instrument of Wickard v. Filburn. I respectfully but forcefully disagree with that conclusion. But I will say this. If that is the case, if the Supreme Court is willing to go as far as to say Wickard v. Filburn necessarily means that Obamacare is constitutional, then Wickard v. Filburn and its progeny is wrong and must be overturned. Wickard v. Filburn, in other words, must be read in pari materia with the Constitution itself, with the 10th Amendment, with the enumerated powers doctrine. And when it is, we see that there has to be a limit. There must be a limit somewhere, because if there isn't a limit, our individual freedom, our liberty, that which our forefathers fought to protect, that which caused us to become our own country, the very reason why I'm speaking to you not with a British accent, the very reason why when I go into court, as I used to go into court, I don't get to do that anymore. Maybe I can find an excuse to at some point. I don't wear a wig. This is the reason why we are our own country, because we made a decision that we were going to have limited power at the national level. And that's not just an abstract, esoteric objective. It's not just something that the history books tell us was a good idea at some point in time. It is the law, and it's a law built on the inevitabilities of life. It's a law based on the fact that it is unfortunately the nature and disposition of mankind. That when individuals acquire power, they don't want to relinquish it. They want to exercise that power as long as they can and as much as they can, with as much force as they can. I don't know why, but it happens. And we have to do something about it. The courts, unfortunately, have not been as jealous of this power as they should be. In other words, they haven't been the careful guardians that we need them to be. And that being the case, we as voters, we as citizens have to start putting more and more pressure on the political branches to do that which is their job, to do that which is consistent with their oath to the Constitution, to recognize that there are limits no matter what the policy objective is that you're trying to achieve, no matter how virtuous or otherwise beneficial the policy objective we're trying to achieve. When that's put into practice, it can be painful. it can be really difficult. I had a situation just yesterday in which members of my party had put forward a proposal consisting of a lot of bills rolled together. I agreed with almost all of them. Almost all of them achieved some favorable policy objective. But there was one with which I fundamentally disagreed, not because it was bad policy, but because it was utterly irreconcilable with principles of federalism to which I took an oath. There was one portion of this Republican jobs package that would have told state courts, applying state law, reviewing state causes of action, that they were subject to certain limits, all in the name of interstate commerce, all because these things, like everything else, have a substantial effect on interstate commerce. I wanted to vote for the bill. Were I a member of the state legislature in the state of Utah, I would have voted for that kind of tort reform, but I couldn't do it because it's not within my power. It was painful not to be able to vote in favor of that bill, but sometimes we have to do painful things, even when they undercut our underlying policy interests. In other words, just as textualism and originalism need to be protected and preserved, they need to be followed religiously so that they don't come under fire, and correctly, as I believe, as simple tools to bring about a conservative philosophical revolution of sorts. We in the political branches of government, who are dyed-in-the-wool advocates of federalism, need to stick to federalism. Federalism is the answer, not just because it leads to right results, but because it is the right result, and it is the law. At the end of the day, it may be that we've simply allowed the political branches to get away with this too long. They haven't had to answer these difficult questions. As Benjamin Franklin was often quoted as saying, he'll cheat without scruple who can without fear. And as long as members of Congress aren't ever asked the question, even if it's only by a small handful of their constituents, where do you get this power to vote for Bill X or Resolution Y? As long as they don't feel that pressure, they're not going to restrain their own power. But I've found that when they do feel that pressure, they will start to think about it. They'll read it. And I can speak from experience. There have been times when constituents have brought to my attention something that I may not have thought of about a limitation of the Constitution, and when it's brought to my attention, I'll look at it. I know I'm not alone in this respect. There is something about human nature that causes us to behave this way. One day when I have time, I want to learn more about psychology. I want to write a book about political psychology. You could have a heyday with analyzing and psychoanalyzing members of Congress and why they make their decisions. But I find that you find the greatest restraint within Congress when members of Congress understand that the buck stops with them. In other words, I haven't seen a lot of abuse of the impeachment power, and I've wondered at times whether this is due in part to the fact that there is no role for the courts in the impeachment power, such that the job of interpreting and construing the terms like high crimes and misdemeanors rests exclusively with Congress. They're actually pretty careful about that. And you'll actually find members of Congress in both houses and in both political parties doing original document research to figure out what high crimes and misdemeanors are. They do that because they understand that that's their job, that's exclusively their job, and it's no one else's job. Now, in the case of construing the Commerce Clause and other affirmative grants of authority, there is a role for the courts to play. But we need to restore the era. We need to restore the mindset in which members of Congress understand that it is also their job, notwithstanding that the courts may have a role and that the president has a role, to decide how far those powers ought to extend. Once we do this, we can restore the greatness of America. I love how Frank Easterbrook put this. He explained that at each stage, each member of our government, each officer has a role to play. He said, Constitutional limitations constrain government power. No one may go to jail. The government may not act in many other ways unless multiple holders of power concur in the constitutionality of that decision. So, for example, in the criminal context, Congress must enact a law, the executive branch must prosecute, the court must convict. At each individual step, the person exercising the power of government must decide whether the Constitution authorizes the step. So today I call for a restoration of this principle of coordinate branch construction of the Constitution. I call upon all Americans, not just all members of the Federalist Society, but all citizens everywhere who love freedom and want to avoid tyranny, to start asking the difficult questions of those who occupy the political branches, those who hold offices therein. Where do you get your power? Where do you get your power to enact law A, B, or C? If we just start asking that question, I think we'll all be surprised at how much good that does. Because as we restore principles of federalism, we restore limitations on power. And as we do that, we prevent the consolidation of power in the hands of the few or even in one government. When we do that, we fight for freedom, we fight for liberty. We fight for that which is truly American. We fight for that which is our birthright, which is prosperity born of freedom from oppression. With these principles, we can get there with your help and with the help of those who wrote that document 224 years ago that has fostered the development of the greatest civilization the world has ever known. May God bless the United States of America. Thank you.
So if you have a question, just line up at one of the two mics in the center aisle.
Thank you for coming, Senator. Anthony Bruno, you mentioned Justice Scalia appearing in front of the Judiciary Committee a couple weeks ago, and I believe it was you, please correct me if I'm wrong, you had an interesting exchange with him about the role of the administrative state and the delegation doctrine. And in watching that exchange, I thought I was a little surprised because it seemed Justice Scalia, who takes a fairly broad view of the power of legislative power within the executive to set rules. And I found that hard to kind of square with how he jealously guards executive power. If you read his Morrison v. Olson dissent, where he talks about the executive power belongs in the president. Similarly, the legislative power belongs in the Congress. And I think the way he tried to square that circle was he said, if you look at executive power, there is a legislative element to it because you have to establish rules for how you're going to execute the laws, what time the doors open and that type of those type of rules. But I thought that was kind of a far cry between substantive rules, which affect the legal rights of the people in which the regulations are being enforced upon. And I was just wondering your view on that exchange and anything you would like to add.
Great. My view has long been that although Justice Scalia was certainly correct in pointing out what he pointed out in that exchange, which was that there is a lot of power within the executive branch to decide, I think as he put it, you know, what time the lights go on and what time the lights go off in the Department of Commerce, internal regulations for how they're going to be governed. At some point, you leave that field. Now, this part is me speaking, not him. This is where I would go a step further. Unfortunately, we didn't have enough time to explore this in great detail. But I'm firmly of the opinion that we've got a problem both with Article 1, Section 1, which says, the legislative power of the United States shall be vested in Congress, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives, with that clause and with the presentment clause, which says that in order for something to become law, it has to be passed by both houses of Congress, then it has to be presented to the president for signature or veto. So the problem that we have today is that we have, so far today, I don't know how many of you read the Federal Register every day, but we're up to 68,500 pages, roughly, of regulations. New regulatory law added just this year. This in addition to the existing Code of Federal Regulations currently occupying, I don't know, 160,000, 170,000 pages or so. Meanwhile, Congress has passed about 1,500 pages of law this year. Some would say that's 1,500 pages too many. Well, maybe they're right. But the point is, they're making a lot more law than we are. There's some fluff buried in those 67, 68,000 pages so far this year, but not all of it's fluff. Some of it really is substantive law. So I think it's a huge problem, both under Article 1, Section 1, and under the presentment clause, that we have that much law being created every single year that is passed not by anyone who stands at regular intervals accountable to the people, but by people who are not elected by anyone and who aren't accountable to anyone who is elected. That's one of the reasons why I support a proposal known as the RAINS Act, which would say that at least for those regulations that are considered major rules by OMB, that is those having an economic impact in excess of $100 million a year, at least those ones at a minimum ought not take effect unless or until Congress in both houses has passed them and submitted them to the president. I think this is a huge pressing issue and might well be the subject of another speech I give at the Federalist Society at some future date.
Senator Lee, in last week's Senate Judiciary Committee oversight hearing for U.S. DOJ, your questioning of General Holder touched on Justice Kagan's role in participating in the development of the strategy for the administration's defense of the Obamacare law. Based on what you've seen, do you have a view on whether she can participate in any Supreme Court review of the constitutionality of that law?
I haven't seen enough to be able to make that assessment. I think it is a legitimate question, and that's why I asked Attorney General Holder whether he intends to comply fully with the request for documents submitted by the House Judiciary Committee a week ago today. I think this is immensely important, and because, as you know, Justice Kagan served as Solicitor General prior to going on to the Supreme Court, and the Solicitor General is responsible not just for handling litigation in which the United States is a party before the Supreme Court, but also in managing the federal government's efforts in all appellate litigation everywhere, and frequently the Solicitor General is brought in to consult on issues that are either pending in lower courts or in some cases even litigation that's contemplated but not yet filed. So I think it's important that the Attorney General respond to that. Interestingly enough, when I asked him, do you intend to respond to this, he answered simply by telling me, oh, you know, that's really not a problem because we walled her off. So my response to that was, okay, well, if that's the case, Mr. Holder, I'm sure you will feel very comfortable responding to our request for documents. So he didn't have a response to that. Yes.
So, Senator, I very much agree with much of what you said, but I do notice one potential tension in your remarks in that you said at the start, and quite rightly, that perhaps the court should not be so deferential to Congress's judgment of what's within its own powers if Congress, or at least much of it, is not taking that responsibility of judging constitutionality seriously. But then you later said, well, with impeachment, Congress does take it seriously because there's no judicial role. So I wonder whether it might be the case in the Commerce Clause area or other federalism questions that if Congress thought or knew that the legislation they passed would face not less deferential judicial scrutiny, that would give them a stronger incentive to consider ahead of time, is this really constitutional? Is it really going to pass muster? As opposed to saying, well, if the courts will defer to our judgment, then we actually don't need to engage in much judgment because they're going to defer to us anyway, so why bother sort of doing the hard work?
That is a very fair observation. I will say this. The fact that members of Congress don't limit their own power nearly as much as I think they should with regard to, say, the Commerce Clause or the Spending Clause is a reason why I think the courts should look more aggressively to restrict that power. But it is also a reason why members of Congress should take it more seriously. So we've got to do both. In other words, members of Congress are capable of engaging in this kind of analysis because we see it where they feel the need to do it. They feel the obligation. I think a lot of it has to do with the need to educate members of Congress over the fact that they have that role. But at the same time, I think this also doesn't justify the courts in continuing to give a very deferential approach toward reviewing congressional acts passed under the Commerce Clause, because they're just there's no real filter there, as evidenced by the fact that we legislate ourselves to death. I mean, that's how we got to the point where we're almost $15 trillion in debt, and we have what some estimate to be as much as or even in excess of $100 trillion in unfunded entitlement liabilities. There's no real filter there. So we need to install a filter in Congress, but we also need more filtration from the courts than we've been getting since 1937.
Senator, thank you for your leadership on federalism. You talked about the importance of Congress weighing in on the meaning of the Constitution. And there's been a lot of attention here and in other places to the meaning of the Commerce Clause and the meaning of the Tenth Amendment. But isn't, in terms of the power that underlies federalism, the meaning of Article 5 even more important? And when Article 5 says that the Congress, whenever two-thirds is of both houses, shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments, or on the application of state legislatures, of the legislatures of the several states, shall call a convention. Isn't the question of whether the convention that Congress must call can be limited to the subjects that the states, the subject or subject, or even the specific amendment that the states have asked for? Isn't the question of whether the states have that power to force Congress to limit a convention one of the most important textual questions still outstanding in terms of the Constitution? And wouldn't it be useful for members of Congress to weigh in on their interpretation of that point? Since if Congress believes that states can limit a convention, we don't have the risk of a runaway convention, and states have the power to propose a specific amendment.
Yes, I think that is important. I think members of Congress probably should weigh in on that. Members of Congress have understandably been not terribly inclined to do that, in part because this could change at any time. The fact that members of Congress may say that today doesn't bind members of Congress that might be called upon to convene a constitutional convention 10 years from now. But that said, I think members of Congress would do well to read a 1979 Office of Legal Counsel opinion memorandum authored, I think, by Walter Dellinger, which addresses some of these points in a lot of detail. I read that recently, and he makes some excellent points. All of that said, I think the best way to amend the Constitution is the same way we've amended it all 27 times, which is for Congress to propose the amendments and for the states to ratify after that.
Senator Keith Rothfuss from Pittsburgh, I applaud your sticking to principle on the attempts to federalize certain state causes of action. And I saw that problem last year with some of the MedMail reform proposals that were coming through where they're attempting to federalize your basic medical malpractice case. I wonder if you could comment, though, whether there might be a legitimate use of the spending power to achieve some kind of medical malpractice reform, particularly when the federal government is paying for health care.
Well, okay, so if the question is whether there are appropriate instances in which Congress may enact medical malpractice reforms, yeah, I think they are. They're probably relatively limited if we stick to a pretty tight reading of the Constitution. I think it would probably need to be limited to lawsuits brought in federal court under federal law for us not to be intruding on some dangerous territory. I suppose one could make an argument that if you tied it to medical malpractice related to the provision of medical services with the use of federal funds, that could also be a way of getting you there. Now, that's piggybacking on top of another arguable excess of federal power, but you could do it that way. I suspect the courts would uphold it, and you could make a credible case that that is an appropriate exercise of power.
Senator, in the framework of coordinate review, I'm wondering what your thoughts are with respect to presidential signing statements and whether that's an abdication of the president's responsibility to exercise his own independent judgment and veto something that he believes is unconstitutional rather than signing it and saying, oh, there's constitutional problems and we'll choose not to enforce those provisions that we think are unconstitutional.
Yeah, good question. So I have nothing against presidential signing statements across the board. The president can say anything the president wants upon signing a piece of legislation. But if what the president is saying, and I think this is what you're getting at, is I'm going to sign this notwithstanding the fact that I have grave reservations as to the constitutionality of this measure, so we'll just let the courts work it out. I think that's spineless. I think that's horrible. I think that's a derogation of the president's oath. Yes, sir. This is Will Scharf. He's the former president of the Harvard Federalist Society, who led the Harvard Federalist Society in an outstanding, inspiring USA chant when I spoke at Harvard recently. So he's
after that sort of introduction, I think this question is going to be a horrible disappointment for everyone in the crowd. I'm curious how you would view something like, for example, the Class Action Fairness Act of 2005. Which I think, based on sort of the text of the Constitution, is pretty clearly authorized. I mean, it's you know, based on the text of the Constitution, a proper exercise of federal extension of federal jurisdiction. And I think that many people in the room would agree that it advances conservative policies in terms of reining in what was in many states an out of control situation with class action lawsuits. But at the same time, it's federalizing jurisdiction that. That had always previously been something that the states were handling. How do you deal with the tension with sort of these broad principles of federalism, where you don't have a textual hook to say something that is explicitly unconstitutional, to say that something is explicitly unconstitutional?
Okay, I'm not as familiar with that piece of legislation as I need to be, and I don't feel equipped to speak to specifically to that one and say whether or not it crosses the line. Although I'm a lawyer, my specialty has never included class actions, and so I just haven't dealt with that one. But I will say there are tools that we have at our disposal, and as lawyers, there are tools that we have that judges use, including and resembling tools of statutory construction that help us figure out whether or not this crosses the line. And as my law professor Fred Geddix used to say, you draw the line at 7. And I would ask him, how do you find 7? And he'd say, well, there's the answer. It's not quite as squishy as Professor Geddix's comment there might have suggested. If you can look at something and say, this moves us in a direction of more limited power, this moves us in a direction that brings us closer, brings the status quo closer to the constitutional vision of limited government, then you might consider voting for that. But anytime we are federalizing that which has appropriately been entrusted to state power, we've got to proceed with grave caution, because 99 times out of 100, we're doing it wrong if that's what we're doing. And in the one instance out of 100, then we will find some express authorization in the Constitution for us to do that. Let me put it differently. From a policy standpoint, there are a lot of times when we're going to have a really good idea in Congress. Well, maybe not a lot of times. It happens. I mean, even a stopped clock keeps correct time exactly twice a day. So with 535 people serving in Congress, once in a while you're going to find a good idea. But we have to be comfortable with the fact that just because something is a really good idea, just because it benefits someone, just because it might improve something, doesn't mean it's ours. Any more than the fact that, Will, when I look at your tie, I can say, I really like that tie. It's not mine. It doesn't belong to me. And I can't take it away from you. I won't, Will, I promise. So that's what we have to do. We have to be jealous guardians of our own power, keeping in mind the fact that those we represent need us to exercise our power cautiously, because what we're doing when we do that is we're reserving power to them. It is no accident that the 10th Amendment says that powers not granted to Congress are reserved to the states respectively, comma, or to the people, because when you reserve power to the states, you are reserving it to the people. The representatives at the state level are closer to the people, they see them, they interact with them more frequently. That's where the people are the most powerful. That's where tyranny presents the greatest threat. Thank you very much.